Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Ali Sadiq. Particularly in stand-up, I think of stand-up, a good joke can be written well and the mechanics of it are effectively surprising or interesting or novel, but greatness needs an audience to sort of dictate what really resonates with people and also how to make it so it really resonates with people. Ali Sadiq is a comedian who thinks of stand-up as a conversation where just the comedian is talking. And so through how the audience responds with laughter, or not just laughter, with silence, with little noises, the comedian, if they're properly connected, will add more to the joke, will change how he phrases certain things, will change the pacing of the story he's telling, will act bigger, will act smaller. And it is that's what makes it a collaboration, is they are a good comedian is actively working to better the material through how the audience is responding. So in 2015, Ali Sadiq was asked to perform for the Comedy Central storytelling show, This Is Not Happening, in which he told the story of a particularly bad day early in his stint at a Texas prison early in the 90s. Ali did not know it was great. He thought it was like a story he had. Friends told him, hey, you should tell this story. And through the response in the room and then through the response online, he realized the story, which has become known as Mexicans Got on Boots, was sort of like an instant classic. It went viral. It now has, I think, almost 10 million views on YouTube alone. It went viral in a way that nothing he's done had. He already had been doing stand-up for 17 years. He had a number of TV appearances. He released 3 albums already. But this story ended up being sort of an unexpected jolt to his career. The next year, he got a half-hour special on Comedy Central. The year after that, in 2018, he released It's Bigger Than These Bars, which was an hour special he shot in a Texas jail. It does what great stories do, but stand-up stories have a hard time doing, which is having a story that shows what it was like without necessarily having just to tell people what it was like. This is a very funny story about a really painful, dark day for Ali. And it's a thing that you don't really realize until after you've heard the story and you think about it a little bit. The one thing you should know, as you won't be able to see the joke, is that Ali is sitting down. Ali always sits down when he performs. It's one of the many things that make him such a unique stand-up performer. So here is Ali Sadiq.
My story is about prison, danger, seeing that I look so menacing, you know, and I'm black, so you know it's going to be about crime. Let me tell you, prison is an odd place because you do not know the rules. No matter how many prison movies you watched and documentaries of locked up, you still don't know the rules of what's going to happen. So I'm on my way to what they call necessities. Necessities is, you know, where your clothes, you get your laundry and all that bullshit. So I'm walking to necessities and a dude just walks by and say, "Mexican got on boots." I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? Because it's like, I've been in prison like the first day. What you mean Mexican got on boots? Everybody got on fucking boots. So I thought. Dude walked past, "Mexican got on boots. Mexican got on boots." So I tell somebody else, "Mexican got on boots." Dude looked down and say, "Mexican do have on boots," and just take off running. I'm like, was I supposed to run? Because the Mexicans have on boots? So I asked the old dude, I said, "Hey, Mexican got on boots." He say, "All right, they got on boots." I said, "What that mean?" He say, "It's going to be a riot." I said, "You pretty calm about a riot." I said, "How you know Mexicans got on boots mean it's going to have a riot?" He said, "Because Mexicans don't wear boots on the rec yard." I said, "Okay. What they wear in the rec yard?" He say, "Sneakers. They play handball all the time." And then you looking, you see Mexicans over there playing handball, but they got on boots. So I'm like, doesn't still don't comprehend. So I get back to my cell. I say, "Hey," to my cellie, I say, "You Mexican, what Mexican got on boots mean?" He say, "That mean we gonna ride. We gonna stab a couple of black guys up." And I asked, this when you in prison, you ask dumbass questions. I'm like, does the ride happen in here? Like in this cell? Cause me and you just finished eating together. What you mad at me about? I don't know. But this is when you learn that you stick with your race in prison, no matter what, you stick with your race. I don't know why I can't have a Mexican friend. He's in my cell. I don't know what the fuck is going on, but Mexican got on boots, and I got to figure out what I'm supposed to do now. And I still don't know. I got to still ask people. Found a black dude. I'm like, "Yo, so what I do now that Mexican got on boots?" He say, "You gotta find you a knife." I say, "I gotta find a knife? Ain't no, you can't have no knife in prison." He said, "You just got here, huh?" I said, "Yeah, I just got here." He said, "Man, look, you gonna need to find a dude named CeCe and get you a knife. It's 3,000 people on this unit. How the fuck I'm supposed to find CeCe? I don't know." So I'm just walking around, "Miss got on boots, CeCe. Mexican got on boots, CeCe." Dude say, "Hey, you looking for CeCe?" I say, "Yeah, you must need a knife." I say, "Yeah." He say, "Why you need a knife?" I say, "You ain't hurt?" He say, "No, I ain't hurt shit. I've been away work all day." Mexican got on boots. He take off running. I take off running after him only because he never told me what CeCe was. I catch him, he say, "Man, go on the rec yard. CeCe gonna be on the rec yard." And I'm like, "I don't wanna go on the rec yard. I just left the rec yard. That's how I found out Mexican had on boots." So I'm sitting on the rec yard, looking around for somebody who may look like a dude named CeCe. So I'm asking, I'm looking, I'm waiting. I say, "Somebody gonna speak to CeCe, got to." Dude walk, "What up, CeCe?" I say, "That's who I'm looking for right there." I see CeCe, I nod. He nod back. I say, can I come over there? He say, come on, young blood. I get over there. I say, hey, CeCe, Mexican got on boots. He say, I heard. I say, I need a knife. He say, well, come to my cell in a couple of minutes. I'm going to hook you up. I get to the cell. I say, CeCe, I need a knife. He said, which the shit turned different. He said, what type of knife? I don't know. I just fucking got here. He said, what type of knife you looking for? I say, something sharp, something to poke a motherfucker with. I don't know. So he put up a towel and say, hold on, let me show you some knives. He put up a towel, went under this mattress, took some shit out, slid some shit back, and now it's 8 knives in front of me. It's like I'm at fucking Macy's. I'm like, yo. I'm like, you know, what kind of knife you want? I said, well, you know, what kind of knife I need for a ride? I ain't never been to ride before. He said, well, you gonna need something where you can stick multiple people and it break off. I say, is that right here on the thing? He say, no, these are personal knives. What you want your knife made out of? I say, there's too many fucking choices, man. I just need a knife to protect myself. He said, well, goddammit, listen to me, man. Do you want it made out of wood, plastic, metal, or what? I say, CeCe, listen to me. I don't know, because I've never been to ride before. What's going to protect me? He say, fuck, new ass motherfucker. Like, it's wrong to be just getting to prison. I don't want to be here from the beginning. So calling me new don't mean shit to me. So I said, so man, what would you suggest? He said, I suggest something personal, like a pen top. Pen top? I want a fucking pen top knife. I want a real knife, something I can just get in there with. He said, no. What you get, pen top is a knife with a pen, but you push a nail through it, and then you put the top on it and just have it in your pocket so we can walk around with it. I say, that sound pretty cool. But would that sustain with a riot? He say, no, that ain't riot knives. That's just personal walk around. I say, motherfucker, I need a knife for the riot. Because Mexican got on boots. I said, man, how much is a personal knife gonna cost me? 2 bags of coffee. Come back a little later on the day. I said, what is the riot? Jump off before I get the knife. He said, that ain't my business. That's on you. I said, cool, CeCe. So I wait 3 or 4 hours, and I knew he was working on my knife because I was down the cell and I heard on the ground. I said, yeah, my knife gonna be sharp than a motherfucker. Because I'm hearing it. I'm like, ch-ch-ch-ch. I'm hearing it. I'm like, yeah, I can't wait. And I'm practicing in my cell how I'm going to use my knife. Practicing my shit. So then this dude named Mitch say, hey, you getting you a knife? I say, yeah, CeCe working on my knife. He say, what kind of knife you get? I say, what the fuck is all the knife questions? I say, I got me a nice little knife. He say, it's long. I can hit 2-3 people. He say, man, you need more than that. I say, what I need now? He say, you need to know about how to fight in a riot. I say, how you fighting a riot? He say, Mexican got on boots. This is the reason why they have on boots. So they can kick you in this fucking shin while you fighting. Boots are made out of metal. The metal is a metal tip boot. So you got to do this. This is Mitch. This is in my cell teaching me how to be in a riot. Look, first of all, when you get out there, stay close to the wall. Because motherfuckers going to be trying to stab you. I said, that's pretty much what a riot is. So he said, I got that part off the top. That's why I'm getting a knife. Okay. So he say, you're going to have to do a rock and lean. I said, what the fuck is a rock and lean? Mexicans going to come out there. They going to have their knives. You're going to have your shirt off with your knife. And when you do this, you're going to have to rock to see what foot the Mexican going to kick you with. I said, this is too much. This is too much. It's like a fucking choreographed dance. I don't know what the fuck is doing. So I'm waiting to get my knife. I'm in there fake rocking, trying to see what foot gonna come up. How to do that? Well, you ain't in the fucking ride yet. I don't know, but I'm out there practicing. I go back to CeCe. I say, yo, CeCe, I gotta go to the rec yard. Shit look like it's finna get live. I need my knife. He say, man, I just sold your knife. I say, man, what the fuck, CeCe? You said it was a personal knife. For me, it cost 2 bags of coffee. Why it's not fucking personal no more? He say, man, it was personal. Then a dude came in with 3 bags of coffee. Then it made it business. I say, so you sold my knife? He say, yeah, sold your knife. I say, the ride about to jump off. Hey, man, do what you can do. So moral of the story, how I end up, I fucking get cut. Because I ain't have a fucking knife, and I forgot to rock. I'm out there rocking with no knife. I've been practicing shit for 2 hours. Rock. I'm not getting kicked, but I'm getting cut. I got cut down my side from a Mexican who didn't even have on boots.
So I'm here with Ali Sadiq. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me very much.
So I'd like to tell the story of you and this story and your history in comedy in chronological order. And so after hearing that story, which is a bit of a snapshot of that day, I feel like people would be interested in hearing what the full day was like so we can get a sense of what you were actually eventually working with when you were going to talk about it on stage decades later. Can you, you know, you don't have to go in as much detail, but can you sort of walk me through the actual day where Mexicans Got Boots On sort of was generated? Not the making of, but the actual day where that ride happened.
The day, I don't remember the exact date, but I was on this unit, Torres unit in Hondu, Texas. Not knowing that I was going to actually ever tell this story to anyone outside of my friends. So the day started with a altercation early on that day between two individuals that I had no knowledge of. Mm-hmm. And I just got transferred to that unit. I was coming from another unit, and I didn't really know. I wasn't familiar with how this particular unit operated at the time, because this was like a what they called a rock and roll unit. It's what you know, where they kind of always fighting. And I came from a more laid back kind of unit. They actually shipped us over there, me and some older guys, to kind of get the unit under control, as how older inmates kind of give. That's how I was pretty much subdued, because I came from an older unit. I was fighting at first, and then old guys kind of talked me into, like, hey, man, that's not how you want to do your time. So so I get to this unit, and it felt like a little tension, you know, because this is one of those type of units, man, that they just they looking for altercation. So something happened early that day, and I happened to be going to getting ready to go to necessities. And this guy was like, yo, man, I'm gonna walk with you because I don't know what's going on with these Mexicans. They all of them got their boots on.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And I said, I don't need nobody to walk with me. I'm cool, fam. So he's like, nah, man, I'm trying to tell you something happening, because the Mexicans on this particular unit, which is it's a cross between, because it's several Hispanic gangs on a prison unit in Texas. So these particular people were from the Mexican mafia. They was out of San Antonio. And so you have Texas Syndicate and RU and Mexico and Azteca and all these other different units. But these particular guys were from Mexican Mafia. And all of them, they usually would be playing handball. And they don't wear their boots to play handball. So the fact that they had their boots on kind of prompted people from that particular unit to notice something was happening. And then getting the backstory about the altercation that happened earlier in the day. So I was getting ready to go to get my clothes. And this guy from another building, because I was on four buildings, this guy from another building said, "Hey, man, have you heard?" And I was like, "Heard what?" He's like, "The Mexican got them boots on." You know, just to put, you know, to put it in perspective, it was another black guy trying to give me a heads up that something ain't right. Something's going, something jumping off. So kind of watch your back, and you walking out here by yourself.
Yeah.
And I was like, I thought I was all right, even though somebody just told me, "Yo, I'm gonna walk with you." So everybody in twos or whatever. I actually saw other people walking together, and I'm just like, I don't know nobody, so I'm cool. Yeah. I'm rolling by myself. And I at the time I just got there, so I didn't even know one of my dudes that I had saw earlier on another unit named Mitch. Mitch was on the same block.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know because he hadn't been out of his cell. So end up going to necessities, and people was explaining, other black dudes like, "Yo, man, you out here walking by yourself. The Mexicans catch you by yourself, it's gonna be a problem." I'm like, but what is, I don't even know what's going on. Yeah, so yeah. What is the problem? You know, I came to prison by myself, so I'm not accustomed to being with nobody else. He's like, "Nah, man, you gotta partner up until we figure out when they gonna attack." You know, so when I heard it was going down the rec yard, I'm not gonna miss my rec because of no fight. You know, that ain't got nothing to do with me. In my mind, it don't have nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But they like, "Nah, man, on this particular unit, it's like when it start, it's like black against Mexican. Like, they don't care if you ain't got nothing to do with it or not." I'm like, "Well, that's dumb. Because I didn't come from a place like that." Yeah. I came from a place that you would just attack, you know, the same person that you dealt with. I came from a unit that was kind of segregated with, if you from Houston, you roll with people from Houston. If you from Dallas, you roll with Dallas. And then even down segregated further than that, if you from the south side of Houston, you roll with south side people. It's just like if you from the north side of the southwest, you know, I happen to be from the southwest of Houston. So when after coming from necessities, my celly was a Mexican guy. And I was like, "Yo, and he happened to be from San Antonio."
Yeah.
So I'm like, "Yo, man, I see your people got on boots. What's that about?" And he's like, "Oh, man, it's gonna be a race riot. We're gonna stab up some black dudes." And I was like, "So do the riots start in here so I can get it understood how I'm gonna approach this situation?" And then like, so that's the lead up to how it, but the day was longer than the 16 minutes that I told. It's like, "Yo, man, after we were gassed, a lot of us was restrained. Like, they restrained the whole rec yard in these plastic ties. And it was people that was out there that wasn't even in the riot, that wasn't fighting, that wasn't doing anything. It was people bleeding and got cut. You know, I got cut out there, but I was cool. And you just was, the worst thing was being hogtied on the ground with gas. You'd already been gassed, and now you hogtied on the ground. And we was out there for maybe like 6 or 7 hours while they was sorting through what happened and who was involved and what knife was with who. And you know, and then it's white guys out there. It's like, "Yo, man, I was just out here playing volleyball." it was a lot. Like, when my friend's Red, he was like, "Yo, man, I just came out here to get some fresh air," because he was pissed. He's like, "Man, you young people out here fighting. I came out here to get some fresh air." I'm like, "Man, I'm not. I was just out here. Yeah. I wasn't even involved." I said, "How you hogtied blaming people for what's going on?" I didn't even know him like that, but that's how we got cool, being hogtied next to each other. So after that, we were put into the gym and sorted out, and some people were put in lockup that was orchestrators of the riot. And then others like myself, they locked the unit down for like 3 or 4 days. We just in the whole unit was locked down besides kitchen workers. And that's when you got to know a lot of people, because you just in your cell and you in the cell with somebody else. So you got him to talk to, and then you at the bars hollering. I think that was the first time I had ever talked to somebody just through the bars that I couldn't see.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just hollering across the day room.
Considering that this sort of riot was new for you, and the experience was like seemingly such a long day of this, what was the impact of this day on you and how you thought about or approached the rest of your time in prison?
My thing was always to, I didn't really get jovial until I went to a maximum security. I went back to a maximum security prison. But this was when I started organizing people together to read and be involved in school and education. So that's the thing. I had already been coached in Amarillo by old guys how to do my time. And I was just feeling like a lot of young cats that was coming to this unit didn't know how to do their time and how to utilize their time. So I tried to be kind of like an example of, hey man, use your time to better yourself, because you won't be in this place forever unless you choose to be institutionalized. Like I never was institutionalized my whole 6 years. So I was just, this just happened to be where I was staying.
Yeah,
that's how this old cat told me to look at my time. He's like, "Yo, this is just an extended stay, man. This is not your life."
Yeah, as you tell it, you started doing comedy in prison, and obviously there wasn't like open mics there. But can you share what that meant to, in a way, be doing comedy or finding your love of comedy there?
I think people take that out of context. I've always said that I found that I was funny.
Yeah.
In prison, because I wasn't doing stand up. I didn't know what it was to do stand up. I didn't know the mechanics of it, you know, and that's one thing that I'm very passionate about when it comes to stand up. I hate the fact that people think that anybody can do what comics do, which is definitely incorrect. Being funny around your friends and your family is different than being in front of an audience of people that don't know you. So I found that I was the same as I was as a kid. You know, I grew up on the back of the bus, you know, or at school talking to my friends, telling funny stories. So this is just a place that I was a little more charismatic and jovially sarcastic. But how I knew that I was going to do stand up when I got out, that was going to be the pursuit of, you know, the duration of my life, was this guy named Rick. He asked me what I was going to do when I got out. And I'd always been this funny dude on the block. And I said, man, I'm gonna probably try to do stand up. And then he told me, he's like, yo, man, I've been here like 10, 15 years. And a lot of people done told me a lot of things, what they was going to do when they got out. Mm-hmm. And I never had a thought about them doing it. I never even believed in it. I was like, nah, that's not what they gonna do. But when you said that you was gonna be a comedian, I was like, yeah, that match your personality. Because, you know, Rick, he knew that how I actually started was I was on Ellis 2, and I was the SSI, which is basically a glorified janitor. for this block, closed custody block. And I had to be over there, and these are people who were locked up 23 hours a day. They didn't have no TV, they don't have no paper, they just in their cell. The library comes and drops off books or whatever, they get fed in their cell, they live there, they do everything in their cell. So I'm the janitor for this particular closed custody. And these people, they usually would, because the janitors were so horrible and didn't care about their, if they got fresh underwear, they got fresh clothes, if their food was hot, you know, they didn't really, a lot of people didn't take care of them like they should have, because you know, they in their cells 23 hours a day.
Yeah.
So when I became the SSI over there, I used to make sure that the block was clean. And because they used to flood the block and burn up stuff. And I just thought, man, like, maybe they doing that because don't nobody keep it like it should be. So I wanted the block to kind of be fresh. So I always had the block smelling like this little pine oil that we had to clean up with. You know, I would mop the run. I would make sure that they had fresh underwear, because what happens in prison, which is when I look back at it, how disgusting it was, even though I know I had the ability to get a brand new pair of underwear, and then I would just keep them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you got to change your underwear out every day when you go to laundry, you go to necessity. I would just keep them and just wash them myself once you get a brand new pair. Because other than that, you wearing, if it's 3,000 people on a unit and you wear a size medium and 900 other people wear mediums, you basically has placed your sack in the direct area of somebody else's sack. You know, so, and then I had worked in the laundry before, so I knew how that operation went. So I'm over there on this block, and you know, it's a mix of people, white, black, Mexican, a couple Asian dudes over there. And I would watch Martin with the intensity of a psychopath. Like, yo, like, I would watch the show like to almost know every line on this show. And then I would, right before I get off, I'd be like, yo, it's TV time. And I would perform the episode of Martin. I would do all the characters. And so I'm Martin, Tommy Cole, Gina, Pam, I'm everybody. And so when Martin went off, I didn't have anything else. So I just started giving basically funny commentary about what was happening in other places on the unit. Or I would talk about certain inmates that was on the block, you know, that we was on the custody block. I would talk about the officers and they would just listen and laugh. And that was my introduction into what I was thinking that stand-up was.
Yeah. Before your comedian, like, this happened to you, this riot happened, and it is an event. Did you think back upon that day? Was it a story you told? Was it a story you thought about? Like, what type of memory, you know, it would be decades before you would tell it. How did it sort of stay with you?
It was because it's what happens. It's like if you learn how to ride a bike or you fell off a bike one day, you know when you fail.
Yeah.
It prompts you. Somebody was like, if they talking about bikes, you're like, yo, I remember when I fell off this bike and bust and cracked my teeth. It's like, you can't forget that event. You know, it's several more events that happened in that 6-year span. I can't forget what it was like for those 6 years of my particular, from 19 to 25. Even if somebody brought up something, it was like, yo, I don't ever realize that I never saw Tupac or Biggie Smalls until somebody bring it up. It was like, yo, in 1996, I wasn't out in 96. Like, you know, so, it's like, I know if somebody says something about the Million Man March, I know what I did on that particular day, and I know I was in prison, and I know exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I orchestrated a peaceful protest on Torres unit to where all the black people that was on the unit, we didn't go to the cafeteria, what they call the chow hall. We didn't go to the chow hall and eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner, which would cost the state upwards of like $100,000 for that particular day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I remember, it's like,
yeah,
you know, I can't forget the first time I was hog tied on the ground for about 8 hours.
But would, even outside of prison, would you before you're told on stage, would you tell this story to friends of like what prison was like? Was it a thing that you told?
You know, me and my friends would talk about stories, and Bill Bellamy was like, yo, man, you gonna have to eventually tell one of those stories. And DL used to tell me, it's like, hey man, your career and the funniest you're gonna be is gonna be based upon how honest you wanna be. You know, and you have a unique story. And in my mind, I've been doing stand-up for 17 years. You know, I was on Comic View and Def Jam and Who's Got... I was on all this stuff. So I never thought to tell prison stories on stage because I didn't want to be this one-trick pony where people thought that that's all that he have. And like, yeah. like, I was doing stand-up 17 years before I ever even told the prison ride story. And because of This Is Not Happening, that was a platform that when I was invited to do the show, and you can tell a true story and it does not have, it's not punchy. Yeah. You don't have to punch it up or none of that. It was this thing where I was like, yo, I didn't know which story I was going to tell. And then my man was like, yo, man, you got to say that story about when you was in that damn riot.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where I went with it, because it was a story. I didn't think that it was too serious. You know, I know it had funny parts in it between me and Mitch and me and I, for the longest, I didn't know why people thought it was funny. I was just telling a true story based upon my time in prison. I didn't see it as a jovial story. You know, I saw it as a, I'm glad I made it out. So I think that's the thing that was so great about that show, that comedians, and especially for myself, got a chance to tell a story without having to punch it up. And yeah. I used to, if I heard somebody's story and I felt like it was punched up, I was like, you know, it's kind of going against what the theme of the show was about, you know. Yeah. And some people's story was just funny in the naturalness of it. You know, like, it's probably, you know, anybody can have something go on in their life, and the naturalness of what happened is hysterical. That's why when Bert Kreischer was like trying to explain to me why this story was so brilliant, I was like, I didn't get it. I was like, it's just a story. He's like, no, it's the way that you're presenting it, you know? And I was like, oh.
I think he, listening to that in particular, he tapped into, you capture sort of you as an older person thinking back of what you were like when it was happening, right? So you have both you in the present being like, it's crazy how naive I was. And you in the, so you sort of bounce back and forth, but when you're telling that story and you're yourself in the moment, there's like a real innocence to you. And you're like, can you believe this guy was so new to prison and he was acting this way? And now we all know. Before This Is Not Happening, especially if you listen to your first few albums, you see you're transitioning to becoming more of a storyteller in general in your act. What caused that transition? What did you look to when you're thinking about, like, maybe I can start doing storytelling? Were there influences? You know, what made that shift? You know, even by your Enjoy Your Life, which is your third album, you had a lot of stories on that one.
The thing was with Rodney Dangerfield, I used to listen to him tell short stories. Like his stories were shorter, but they were still pop, pop, pop. They had this pop to it. And Don Rickles, shorter stories, but had pop to them. And then you got Red Fox. I would be so engulfed in what he's saying. And I was like, yo, man, this is the most powerful position in stand-up, is if you develop to where you can captivate an audience with your ability to tell a story. And you take them on a ride with you. And you link together with some continuity of story from this point to this point to this point, which is what from the prison ride, Mexican got on boots to Mitchell is a transition. I went to prison for a nonviolent case, drug dealing. What he just turned me into was a violent young man at 21, because you made me cough and squat for no fucking reason other than that you wanted to see me in my mind. So now I got tears in my eyes and people walking past, other prisoners walking past, and they looking at Mitchell like, Mitchell, this ain't gonna be good. So for 8 months, I've been planning on killing Mitchell. You know, I was to the point where I could transition from being 19 to now I'm 22, 23 years old. And I'm in a different headspace. And I've been here. And the key to even telling these stories in conjunction to each other is to show the shift in mentality from one being a nonviolent offender coming into this place of violence, and being to shift to being a very formidable, respected, violent, not intentionally violent, but you push me to being violent because you're trying to be disrespectful. And knowing that this is now you have a 22, 23 year old man who actually knows himself 100% and what he gonna stand for and what he not gonna stand for. You know what I'm saying? And to understand that I don't see consequences anymore. Cause whatever comes, I can accept the consequences. You know, from being young and jovial with the whole intention of like, I'ma just make it through this, da da da. And I don't do too much. You know, you can't run over me, but I'm just trying to keep my nose clean to stay out so I can get out. To, I don't give a damn. You're not gonna run over me, and whatever it takes to let you understand that that's what it's gonna be.
Yeah,
you know. So
yeah, no, it felt like, if I'm getting what you're saying, like ultimately you had there's a quote of advice you get, which is that I believe is comedian Billy D. Washington told you, if you're not going to be funny, be interesting. And I think it seems like you were like, oh, I have interesting things to say, and it's okay if there's a time where it's interesting, where that transition is not necessarily funny, but that transition is compelling, and stories allowed you to show both sides of it.
Yes. And it's kind of like me. What I got from being incarcerated from older people and wiser people that I chose to pick to be around is kind of like the same thing I do when I'm in free society. I gravitate towards those people who their energy tells me that they good people and they want the best for me. They give me an interesting perspective on how I should present things, you know, and it's very hard to find people that don't have conflict of interest or malice for you. They just want to see you do your absolute best, and they'll push you to do your best with very unapologetically. Yo, I'm going to tell you this. I don't care how you feel about it, but this is going to be the best position for you if you want to prosper and go further. So, man, that one, I'm very impressed that you have done your research on me, because sometimes the interviews are not you like, so tell me how, man, I done said it 1,000 times. But but that quote by Billy D. Washington is very dear to me, because I think that it gave me something that I didn't have, and it gave me the confidence to be who I am now. Like, yo, mm-hmm. when you're not being funny, be interesting. So when you do a 55 minute set, and then at the end you decide to talk about food deserts, mm-hmm. you know, which is not the lightest of topic, and you understand how you can get rid of food deserts and this, that, and the third, and you leave with that, because in your mind, I've made you laugh for 55 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm taking 5 minutes to give you some other type of food other than laughter. And I don't need to walk off to the rah or whatever. And yeah. So that gives me an advantage over the audience when it comes to being the same. I'm not fearful if you didn't laugh at the end, or I'm not fearful if you don't laugh when I first come out, because I decide I want to do something very intricate that you have to listen to. Mm. Or I want to stop in the middle of my set and say, let's talk about diabetes. You know? No, and you know, that's the beauty of being able to tell a story and, you know, and be vulnerable on stage. And I think people like listening to me because I'm not the hero all the time. Some of these stories I lose in. Some yeah. of these stories I look terrible. Like, I have a new album getting ready to come out, and it's a story about when I decided I wanted to try to talk to Lil' Kim. Because she said, I read her interview, she said she liked regular dudes. And I was like, I'm regular. And and it just didn't go. It didn't go
yeah.
like I envisioned it.
Yeah. You know? We'll be right back with more Ali Siddiq.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
And we're back with Ali Siddiq. So I want to ask a little bit how you approach thinking about which parts of a story, you know, for a story like this that has many elements, you know, in your 2013 album, Enjoy Your Life, you tell a version of the riot story. I wouldn't call it the same story because it focuses less on the Mexicans got boots part of the joke, and it's much more about the knives. And then you talk about the tear gas and you talk about being on the ground, where obviously on This Is Not Happening, it's much more focused on the Mexican got boots. It's like really the sort of like refrain you hit. Can you talk about why for an audience in 2013 or at that time you told one version of the joke, and why for the Comedy Central version you're like, oh, I'm going to focus just on this element? Like, walk me through your thought process so it can get a sense of how you approach sort of different times.
Man, you are really on it. So this is what happens with me.
Yeah.
In the aspect of, I know where I was at what place I was at. I was in the Houston Improv, and the fact that it was so many people there that I had been locked up with. And so the intricate parts of about the being on the ground, it's like, and it was a lot of young people there, and my whole point was stressing, this is not the place that you want to go, because it's not guaranteed that you going to make it out, you know? And it's this whole mindset of this part of it has to be drilled home, that the knife, the danger, the gas, the being on the ground and still being, even in this instance, you still the last people to come in, because they took the white guys in first, then they took the Mexican guys in, and then how you end up on the ground 7 to 8 hours because you black and you out there. And I didn't even put the aspect of some people getting kicked in the face with the boots, and people having to have to use the restroom and just peeing on themselves because, you know, they couldn't take it no more. So the audience, I look out in the audience and I sometimes say, this is what's significant that I need to give them the message of, don't think that prison is cool. I'm not saying that. Yeah. I'm being funny about this story, but let me give you some more understanding about how this place is dangerous.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't want to be there. And this is not a badge or honor. So then with Comedy Central, it is more about the youth in me and the youngness and how I shouldn't be in this particular violent situation as a non-violent offender. And this is where you place me. This is where you place me at. And now I'm here. And this is what I'm dealing. And this is what I'm dealing with from this particular aspect of it. So, man, that's a dynamite question, because a lot of people don't see the transition in certain things. And I'm very, I have a point to why I'm doing certain pieces of a story, because it's significant to who's out there listening. That's the overall answer. It's very significant to who's listening.
Is it a thing like before the taping, would you have done this? Do you do the story to different audiences, see which part, what each responds to? You just sort of an instinct of what they were responding to? Sort of, you know, in general, how are you working on a story?
And I know this is going to sound extra terrible. And extra horrible. And I don't want no young comic to even pick this up. I don't practice it because I know the story. So it's nothing for me to practice. I just got to get out there and feel the audience. It's like I can see it. I can just see it. And I don't know how I see it. I can just see it. Even like, I remember doing my Def Jam set, and I never ran the set of what I was going to do. And I got a standing ovation on it, but I never ran it. I just talked to my boy Dave Lawson, I just talk to him. And it's like I always talk to Dave before I get ready to record something. And I just talk to him. And he's like, yo, man, that's how you do it. And it's like he not giving me pointers. He just telling me how he felt when I was talking to him. It's like, that's how you do it. And it's a thing. And I hate to say it like that, because it sounds like, oh, he just think he good. I'm like, no, I really feel it. Like, I real live feel it, because I love stand-up so much. I know me. So, and when I'm being honest, I don't have to prepare. You know, and I know that sounds crazy. When I did my special in prison, I wasn't running the set places. I was going to clubs, and I'm doing everything but the set that I know that I'm gonna do when I get there, because I know I got to feel it. I have to see them and connect with them. And once I connect with the audience, I think we together, because I want my show to be like, I literally want it to feel like, yo, man, I just finished talking to one of my crazy friends and one of my cool cousins. And yo, man, I want to feel like your friend. Like, I want to feel like I'm a part of your life when the show is over. I don't want to just feel like a performer. Like, I tell very personal things sometimes when I'm doing stories, and some of this stuff is painful, and some of it is just to help, you know. Like, I started telling this story about when my father passed right before my special came out. And this is somebody who used to go to the library and watch everything I did. And before he passed, I wanted to know, did he see the trailer for my special? And he was like, yeah, I saw it. And people, like, I have strawberries in my room, like on my rider, I have strawberries on the thing. And I always want strawberries in my room because my daddy loves strawberries. And I remember, and I was telling this story, like, when he called me, he would call me and say, hey, man, let me tell you, I want you to tell the people. Like, like, what you want me to tell the people? I guess it was this big thing going on with immigration.
Yeah.
And I was like, my daddy told me the most ignorant thing. He called me and said, hey, man, I know you got a little mainstream white audience. Like, you know, mainstream and white is two different things. He's like, you got a little mainstream white audience. Let me tell you what I want you to tell them white folks. I said, what you want me to tell them? Tell them to stop talking about immigration. I said, what? He said, tell them to stop talking about immigration. I said, why? He said, because they ain't going to do nothing to the Mexicans. I said, why you say that? He said, because white folks love strawberries. I said, what does it got to do with immigration? He said, they love them, but they ain't going to go pick them. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, get off my phone. It's like, but then I thought about it. And like, he's correct. But, and I like, I always have strawberries in my room because he loved them. And he was this person that was a empty part of my life, but yet a full part of my life. Mm-hmm. And that seems like it doesn't make sense, because I felt empty when he wasn't around. You know, when he left at 3, he came back around 10. I stayed with him for 2 years and he was gone again, and we didn't speak for a while. But when I needed him, or when he needed me, I felt the need to show up to fulfill some type of void that would be in me. You know, I paid for his funeral. I settled his debt before he died. You know, I remember playing chess with him for 6 hours, 3 hours a day, just us just playing chess before he passed. And I try to, when I say the stories about him, I look at the good the bad parts, and I try to put that on stage. So it's just me being vulnerable in front of an audience is how I decide to tell a story. Because without telling people that, man, this was a, without just blatantly saying, at a lot of times in prison, I was fearful of my life. So instead of just saying that, I just talk about how many knives and how many, and you know, it's just those things without just saying that this, how dangerous this place was. And at 19, it's no way for you not to be concerned about your safety.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that how you talk about that and sort of just like having the stories be and how you sort of show them what is happening without telling them, which is like, this was scary, but like, here is a situation and I'm presenting as it is, and you can laugh at parts of it, but like, you should also be aware that like, this is clearly a scary situation. The thing I was really interested in is how you set up the story. You know, like once you launch into the story, it seems like you're sort of like doing the story, but you say two things before you start, which is, my story is about prison, danger, seeing that I look so menacing. And then you say, and I'm black, so you know it's about crime. And then before you start, you go, prison is an odd place because you don't know the rules. No matter how many prison movies you watch and documentaries of locked up, you still don't know the rules of what's going to happen. Well, why start with that before you get into the story? What does that prime the audience to know what the story is about?
To kind of flush out the nonsense that they see in, without saying how much I hate the Orange is the New Black and Oz and all these things that depict prison as this is not a romantic or a place of this fictitious world that they give people in these stories. And I just try to set it up to understand, like, yo, let me give y'all a glimpse from somebody who was there, not what they want to write, what they want to put down, what, let's cut these parts off. Let me give it to you in a way that you can feel it. I want you to smell it. I want you to taste it. I want you to understand. And maybe you can go back and tell somebody who is in trouble. Maybe you doing some reckless stuff and you can get a glimpse into this world. And it's so many positions that I take on this. Like, I don't know if I've done intake on an album yet. I can't recall. It's so many.
I also can't remember. You might have done it on a prison manual.
Yeah, intake is on the prison manual.
Yeah.
So intake is this place that I want to describe to get people to understand, even though I'm doing it very jovial, but yo, man, this is the worst thing. And it's like to me, it might have been something worse. Somebody might have, well, the food was the worst. No, this part, the beginning, was the worst. It's like the first year of law school where they do all the reading up front. Yeah. This is a long, like, you will be naked in a line more than one time. This is just the first time, and it's terrible. You will do this a lot. Like if you uncomfortable with this, which I was, let's get this understood. This is horrible. And you're going to do it a lot. You're going to be strip searched a lot. It's like ridiculous. And, you know, I just try to set people mind up for the thing. And the weird thing is when I say that this is a story about prison, that's the first part. Then I said, you know, seeing that I look so menacing, second, which I don't. Then two, is that, you know, it's going to be about crime because I'm black. Let me ease your mind with what you thinking. No, it's about crime because it's a prison story.
Yeah.
I just happens to be. So it's like underlying stuff in there for me, because I don't even look like the prison person. Mm-hmm. And that's by design, because I was groomed not to look like that. I was groomed not to talk like that. I was groomed to come out. And when somebody says, oh, you know, he was locked up for 6 years, they like, are you serious? Him? Why? Like, what'd he do? Like, I know him, you know?
Yeah.
To not have this overall, whatever you've heard about prison, I'm not the prison persona, but I can tell you about this place. And I think that's another part of why I'm setting things up like this, because I don't have that prison mystique, and nor do I want it. So I'm the kid next door that you just found out that, like, yo, he was in jail. Like, for what? What did he do? What did he do? Like you can't believe it. And then, like, so, you know, it's underlying things, man, which is the best puzzle that you can leave for the game.
When you're performing this bit, and you're sort of doing your side of the scenes and you're talking to yourself, or even when you are performing as CC or Mitch, do you, like, are you back there? Like, do you, like, how deep into characters are you? Like, when you're telling a story, how vibrant, how real does it feel in that moment?
Oh, man, I am. Okay, let me tell you how real this is with me. So I'm quite sure you heard Mitchell.
Yeah.
I will not perform Mitchell because, and like at the end of my shows, I ask people, is there any stories y'all want me to tell? And people yell out Mitchell. And I say, no. If y'all want me to come out and take pictures afterwards and be okay, you know what I'm saying, then I'm not doing Mitchell. Now, if you don't want that, then I'll do it. But just know I'm going to stay in that green room, because I'd be actually so angry. This happened years and years and years ago, almost 2 decades ago. And I still be angry like it happened just then. So when I'm doing Prison Riot, I am CC at the time. I'm his whole vibe. I'm Mitchell because I'm Mitch because I understood how excited he was, and I never understood why was he this excited. And you know, I always can see, which I hate this, man. I always can see the day room. Like, the whole time I'm telling this story, I'm in the building. I'm in Torres. I'm right on Torres. I'm in the day room. I see Champ on the table. I see people watching TV. Mitch at my cell. Mexican dudes along the top of the run. People in the shower. The control booth. The two officers. The officer walking around doing random checks. And I see CeCe working on this cell, and it is not, I can see the whole thing. Yeah. And I know where I was on the rec yard. I know where I was tied down. I knew, you know, it's just, I can see this whole vibe of this place. And it's like Torres, it's burnt into my memory of how it was the day. I can feel the stillness. And I definitely see when it started to unfold. And when I first heard the first la 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 la, I'm like, what is that, yo? And that's when I'm like, oh snap, this shit is real. Yo, where are they coming from? Like, why is it so many of them? Who, they are very organized. They had a strategy. It's like I can see this whole rec yard just blow up with people fighting and getting stabbed, and then I can see the gas, the canisters coming across the over the gate. But that you'll never forget that that screaming. And they're like, yo, man, this is like an attack call. Okay. And you, it's so vivid. It's so vivid, man. Like how fast it was, but how long it was. Like it started so fast. Mm-hmm. And then it ended. It was no longer than 10 minutes. But that's a very long time. That's three rounds of boxing. This, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, in a break. It's like, and you, it was light outside when I first got tied on the ground. It was dark when I first walked into the gym where they was processing us. It was dark. It was light, then it was dark. And it was, man, it's crazy to sit in the pocket of that story and know that you seeing it and know that you feeling it and you seeing people get kicked in the head. My man, Too Shorty 40 got kicked in his head. Like it looked like he needed plastic surgery after that when they brought him back on the block. And you seeing people go down and you hearing this popping of people's skin. You know, it's this burst that you hear when somebody gets stabbed. It sounds like it's deep. And when you actually feel like you in the old times, what people would be out there fighting with butcher knives. And like, you can't believe that you in this space of hand-to-hand combat. Like, this is real savage. Mm. Like, this is not no, it's a fist fight and it's boxing and you take a round and I take a round. This is savage. And you actually feel in your mind that you have to survive this. You have to. Like, I'm not going to be the person left on the field out here. And that's how you see it. And I'd be in it even though I'm being cavalier about it.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to be left on the field.
Yeah, it's interesting because all of this information is not in this 11-minute story or whatever, but the reason I asked the question is, like, there's clearly, it's like a character, it's like an actor who does like a bunch of pages of like backstory to a character that only has like one scene. It is a bit of like, you can feel so much more weight in the performance because you're remembering all of this, even though you're only telling us like three sentences. Like, you're ultimately trying to capture as much as you can feel, and in a way where you could present it where people are willing to listen to this story or like and are sharing this story because it's so funny. You know, it is interesting that we're talking about something that is a very funny story, because like when you talk about it is, and you remove some of the jokes, a lot of it is like a really difficult, really tragic, really dark stuff. But you're all of that is still in there, and you don't lose sight of that.
I try.
Yeah. So unlike jokes, stories tend to have clearer endings or buttons. And what's interesting is you sort of, you say the moral of the story is, but you ultimately don't give a like one sentence. And that's when I learned blah, blah, blah. You just say, I got a cut on my side by a Mexican who didn't even have on boots, which is like a kind of joke, a jokier ending. What did you want the audience to sort of take away as sort of that as your last statement to them?
When I was telling the story, I actually cut it off right there because I thought that was this is probably the simplest answer of all the questions.
Yeah.
I thought it was just a good cutoff point.
That's fair.
When I did it then, I didn't think to end with what Mitch said to me. I didn't think to do that. And now I think to do it, so it makes the story different, because now I say, I got cut by a Mexican who didn't even have on boots. And so I said, I don't say it like that. I said, I got cut, and I turned right to Mitch. And I said, he didn't even have on boots. And Mitch said, they sneaky like that sometimes. So I ended like that now. But at the time, it was just like a good point of reference to stop at. Like, it goes back to really that they had on boots. And that can't be the only sign that it's something about to happen, because this kid right here didn't even have on no boots, but he down with what they doing regardless. Yeah. You know, boots or no boots. So
it's also like, it's like a story as you presented about how you don't even know what the rules are, and then you learn one rule, which is like, when Mexicans have boots on, that means they're going to riot. And at the end, you're like, oh, even that rule is not a rule.
Yeah. None of these rules, none of this makes sense, because he doesn't have on boots.
Considering how long you waited to talk about prison on stage, you know, what was the reaction to this story, and what was your reaction to that reaction?
Man, the story got it was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It was actually a lot, man. I couldn't believe how this story took off and how people felt this story. And this was at a time where I don't think it was at this time where people were talking about prison reform, or it was just a good story to tell at that particular junction. And then I started feeling the weight of it when, like, how it's twofold. How good it was for my career to get established as a storyteller, and how people gravitate to this story. But then it was very damaging to me personally, because every interview, people would just bring up, like, and then they would ask me ridiculous questions about being in prison, which prompted me to almost go back to the type of person I was when I was in prison. Like, you say something disrespectful to me in prison, I'ma handle you just like I was before I was in the world. So when people so were you trying to be funny in prison to protect yourself? I'm like, yo, man, who are you talking to? You know what I'm saying? Now it's that. Like, who you think I am, fam? Like, what you think? You trying to judge me based upon some shit that you heard of in a movie that Richard Pryor was supposed to have done and he never been to prison? Like, it started giving me this attitude to where I didn't want to even talk about it no more, because this is the reason I didn't do it 17 years prior. And now I'm like, see, this is why I don't do this type of material, because people start to think that's what you are. You know, just like when I was doing NBC's Bring the Funny, this guy wrote this article about ex-convict makes it to the finals of NBC's Funny. And I was like, yo, what they got to do with what I'm doing now? And it's like, yo, if I would have never told this story, if I would have told another story, would I be in this position? Either way, would I be in as seen as I am now, or would I be, you know, still trying to come up in the comedy game? You know, it's a fold. And then it took me back to having to get myself under control based on the advice of, you know, advice that I got from people. Like, yo, man, this is not who you are. Because I wasn't seen as a prison person when I was in prison. It was like I was walking above being someone who was incarcerated. To come out and establish myself in something and then do a story about being there, and then to go back and now you want to see me as a prisoner, as a convicted felon, as a mistake that I made in my past. like it was kind of damaging a little bit, but then I started to understand that everybody doesn't have class or a sense of a sense of character. And, you know, it just go back to once again having something that you have to get a grasp on and understand, and to be happy about something that you accomplished. It felt like they were taking the happiness away from that accomplishment and making me regret telling the story. And I didn't want to live under the shadow of regret. So I kind of just, like, people would ask me questions that I felt like was ridiculous. And then I would, like, you know, try to figure out a way to handle it at that particular time. But I didn't want to go into it from a space of, yo, man, who you talking to? Like, so yeah, yeah. I had to stop going through that space of who you talking to.
It's interesting that you say that. I was wondering that. I mean, I think a lot of comedians, especially because, you know, doing radio or whatever, there are certain interviewers that are getting, like, the, like, one sentence summary of who a person is, and they're like, what's prison like? And they can imagine what the jokes were. But it seems like following your career in the years since, it also seems like you've had a sense of purpose as it relates to how you presented yourself as a person who was in prison, how you present people that were in prison, how you spoke to people that maybe have gone out. Has the notoriety that came with this and the sort of spotlight that has given you, has it given you a sense of purpose or goals in terms of how you want to present this part of your life?
It definitely has. I go in and out of what I be mad about. So I try to talk to the youth more than adults, because I want to try to stop people from thinking that going into prison is even any type of badge of honor. And then I come up to the adults to try to get them to understand that that was something that you went through, not who you are. And then I get caught up in this very... maybe it may be egotistical, maybe it may be, it could be several things. But I hated that Lester Holt interviewed Meek Mills. I found that I hated it, like, more than anything. And I hated Kim Kardashian for this thing. Because it's like, the way that y'all presenting this as this puppeteering of people that's incarcerated. And Meek Mills was like, yo, like, I'm the voice. But you not the voice, because you haven't been through anything. You was on probation. You was in the county jail. You don't have the scars and you haven't developed the mental fortitude of what it takes to even survive out of this place. Like, this is like being drafted into the military, and the first day you get there until you leave, it's absolute war the whole entire time. You know what I'm saying? Whether it's a mental war between you and the officers, you and different inmates, you in the system, it's like, this is a war, and this war is trying to mentally trying to destroy you, and then to put you back into a world and that you don't have any type of, man, you don't have any guidance. You don't have, Meek Mills, you came out of jail and you got picked up by the damn mayor in a helicopter. That shit ain't real. You know what I'm saying? That doesn't happen. They sent me home after 6 years of being incarcerated, they sent me home with $200 and I had no place to stay. Outside of going to my mama house. You know what I'm saying? I paroled under the supervision of my mother. Then I had to meet the man. I'm like, what are you talking about, man? Like, how are you the voice for me? Like, what are you talking about? You know, and it give you this anger how people see it. And you just like, man, do I step out there and say, yo, listen, because I'm a person that came from that position. I'm a person that walked through the steps of what it's going to take to get myself in a better place. I didn't come out rich. I didn't go in with this. I didn't come out with this silver spoon or to someplace to stay. I had to work my ass off from selling clothes to being to working for BFI to being a janitor. So let me get your head wrapped around how many jobs you had in prison. You know what I'm saying? And what your pay was there, whether it was 25 cents. I worked a bunch of jobs for $0. You know what I'm saying? So I can come out with the mental fortitude of working whatever job I have to work in order not to go back there and be satisfied with what the which way I'm going. Hey, this is stepping stones, and look at it and give a clear layout of how to survive not only the incarceration, but the judicial slavery once you get out of the incarceration, and then what it's going to take for you to be seen as a citizen, as a normal human being in this society, and get that gloom and get that shadow of that cloud from over your head. And then on top of that, to become successful in what you choose to be. Not what somebody else is, what you are choosing to be, and be able to live a good life and not be considered a convict or ex-convict or your whatever your past was, whether you was addicted to drugs, whether you was a thief, whether you was a murderer, whatever. This is your second chance, and this is the playbook on how to get that second chance. So. Yeah. How are you not contacting me to say that story? That's the thing. That's the other thing. Like, boy, I was like, wow, man.
You mentioned how you're seen, and I was thinking about that as you're saying that, how, you know, you work so hard not to be necessarily defined by the person who went to prison, and then you sort of do this material later, and you're seen that way. How much are you motivated by how you're seen, how people that went to prison are seen?
I'm very motivated on erasing that stigma that everybody is the same. You know, we have to still get around that. Like, I sometimes won't use certain words if I'm in a conversation with somebody who I can already see has this mental block of what prison is supposed to be. I'm not the big word using dude that don't know the definition of the words and using the words wrong. So brother, I conjugate with the, like with that character that Damon Wayans did on In Living Color. That's still how people see prisoners, you know? And you can tell me if I'm right on this. That permeates in people's mind way more than Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Eddie Murphy in 48 Hours was a comedy that was in a suit that was waiting on that helped solve a crime, got out. He's not, people don't think, when you think about prisons, that never comes up. What comes up is, see, when you defecate, disseminate, it's like, what? You still have something to look over. It's like me and Tim Allen are viewed different.
Yes, I would say that's true.
With the same case, delivery of a controlled substance.
And yet, why? Yeah.
The same exact case. Me and Tim Allen are viewed different. Nobody even asked Tim Allen about prison time.
Yeah. No one asked him, how does it feel to represent people who are in prison?
Not at all.
I think of two things. One, it when you talk about that way, it shows why being in the story and feeling it and making sure you're capturing the people you tell correctly, and you always use their names, and you want to like give them the dignity of being who they are, to explain that like you're not everyone who was in prison. Not everyone wasn't you. What has it meant to be able to do this? As you've gotten more control over being able to talk about prison on your own terms, you talked about it in your Comedy Central special. You then put another album about it. Has doing this material helped you? Has it given you peace of mind? Has it helped you process what was clearly a traumatic time? How has your comedy served you?
Oh, man. It definitely has taken the weight off of my shoulders of hiding. When you get out of prison, because you still have parole and somebody could say something and get you locked back up, you hide a lot. You hide in plain sight. You know, you try to be very elusive and not be seen as much as you should. And it now is just giving me this opportunity for people to know my disposition and know how I am with certain things and why I think the way that I think and I use it when I'm talking to people about how to protect themselves in this society, whether it's women coming home at night or what they should have in their possession or how they should defend themselves, and knowing that a large amount of violent crimes happen against women. So I'm very protective and I try to explain to people, if you've never sat down and talked to a molester or a rapist or these people who have these mental sicknesses, you have to kind of listen to me because I was there with them, you know, and try to utilize what I've been through to help people from the position of I was there, you know. So and to tell people who may be doing wrong things, hey man, this is what you in for. And I'm not going on what I heard, I'm going on what I've done, you know. And it's helped me a lot to be able to pay back some of my debt to society. And it's not, I still think that I owe society something. You know, and just that realization of just knowing that you took something away in society, you damaged your neighborhood, so you kind of owe your neighborhood something. You know, you owe them better representation of a decent human being. And that's what I try to do with my comedy. I think it's giving me that lane in order to kind of pay back some of my debt, my moral debt to society.
Now, 5 years or so after the story came out, like it has become a signature bit for you. You know, people are requesting it. Comedians, no matter how great they are, only have so many of those for whatever reason. Some great comedians just are good, but no one like will name, oh, this is the one thing, you know. I think you have some t-shirts that say it. You know, how do you feel about that now that Mexicans Got on Boots became the sort of signature bit for you?
Man, that, ironically, I just discussed this with a person, and I'm being very honest about this, how I feel about myself. I said, within any era of comedy, I don't care how far you go back or how far you go forward, I'm probably in the top five storytellers based upon just one story that permeated with people. So I'm talking about that penetrated people's minds so deep. Like they like, yo, man, this story right here. And then so it gives people the fuel to listen to other stories and be like, no, he is a great storyteller. Yeah. So it's like I'm very happy overall that story that it wasn't just a right then piece. It's still people that's just seeing it. Like, yo, this story is, it's people who watch it a lot, you know, and it's people who like, yo, any version of it. Like, we do it live. I'd rather you do it live, or I want to see it. Like, yo, this is the thing that I show people. And for something to still be 5 years out, people still say it as a signature line. Like, yo, man, Mason got on boots. You know, like it's not a day I go on Instagram Live and somebody don't type that on there. What's up, Mexican got on boots? Like, I'm very pleased, man. I really am with the success of that story.
That sound means it's time for our final segment, which is a laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because this is comedy, it's a laughing round. It's much shorter, easier questions. And you could pass because who cares? Do you have a joke, or it might be hard since a lot of your things are stories, but is there a joke you wish you could steal, or a joke that you saw another comedian do at any point and you're like, I wish I could have that in my act and like no one would know that I took it, but it'd be mine. I wish I could say that and see what it's like to tell that to people.
Yeah, it's this guy named Charles G. He has a joke about his favorite piece of chicken. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's so stupid, but I'd be like, I just want to do it. It's like, I just want to do it, man. It's just, he go through how many, like, who the breast people, who the thigh people. You know, and like, he go through the whole thing, and then he get to the wings, like, and I'm like, I'm only invested in a joke because I'm a wing person. I'm like, the wing. And like, so I hate that I like it. I hate that I like it.
Do you have any pre-show rituals or superstitions?
Yes. I go to sleep by 3:30. I do not eat after 3 o'clock, and I'm like, I must go to sleep, and I have to have on a watch. Mm-hmm. Like I have to. It's like I will refuse to go on stage if I do not have on a watch. I borrow somebody's watch. If I leave my watch, so I carry at least 3 or 4 watches with me, just in case. But yeah,
What is it about watches?
Because it's about timing.
Yeah,
like I'm not late to anything because I'm a comic, and everything with comedy is about timing. Even with storytelling, it's about timing. So I have to have one to watch, even though I don't look at it. I just have it has to be there.
Do you have any unexpected influences that people would be like, oh, I didn't see that? It might not even be comedic influences, just sort of unusual influences, but you feel like are a big part of your comedy.
Yeah. My friends, man, this guy named Papa Doc and this guy named Phil are huge influences on me. And Phil's a little bit younger than me. Papa Doc is older than me. And they keep me very grounded. And and they challenge me a lot. So those are my influences. And this guy named Jay Knapp, which is Papa Doc's brother, which he is like this constant hustler that still root for you, and but then don't care about your success. It's crazy. Johnny Carson could come back to life and interview me, and just me, and then go back to the grave, and he'd be like, "I saw that little bullshit ass interview you did with Johnny Carson." So you know, it's like me being who I am doesn't mean anything to him, and it's very inspiring.
Do you have a joke that has never worked or rarely works that you tried over and over again that you think is funny, but you can't get an audience to laugh at? Maybe you've given it up, but you're like, you're going to go to your grave being like, that was funny. Those people were wrong.
Nope. Don't have that. I wish I did, but I generally have forced People, I force people to laugh at pretty much everything I've ever done. Now, I don't think I would drop it. I wouldn't keep it. Mm. I just wouldn't keep it. It was like, okay. I'm like, I tried. I did my best, but I guess my best wasn't good. I'm like, no. Yeah, I would drop it.
And last one, do you have a distinct best show of your life where you think back, you're like, that was it?
Whoa. I think I have. Yes, I do. I do. Def Jam 08, those, and it wasn't even a full show. It was just, I was so under the radar at that time. They was looking at everybody else besides me, and this comic is funny, and they would never mention me, which was cool. And then I just felt like that day, I just unleashed that day and just stunned everybody, like from Stan Lathan, Bob Sumner. I just stunned everybody with my performance on Def Jam in 2008. And to this day, I'm like, yeah, that was a pretty good show.
Is that the one where you came out and you like with the stool in your hand?
Yes, came out with the stool. Cause I came out, and I don't know if people saw how I was walking. I was walking with so much determination. Like, yeah. I'm finna get in their ass. Like, man, I was so determined. Cause you know, at a taping, people talking about who they felt like gonna do the best, and I was like, no, okay, they don't see me coming, man. And I am so focused.
That's it. That's all the questions I have. But thank you so much for doing this. That was so good.
Man. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed myself. And thank you for, I'm talking about the really good questions, man.
That's the good one guarantee. I will be ready. That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Ali Sadiq's appearances on This Is Not Happening on YouTube. Follow Ali on Twitter at Ali_speaks. And on Instagram at Ali Sadiq. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at Good One Podcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Be back next week with a rerun of the Desus and Mero episode. Have a good one.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.